This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities, and perhaps a little bit in the natural sciences as well.
Today, yeah.
Together with Amar Fuad Rahmat, who you just heard, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks that better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea that we hope will shed light on the world around you. And the world that we're going to be exploring is the animal world, not from the point of view of ethics, which we've done before, but from, well, the animal point of view. And to help us with that is Lau Yao Hua. He has a PhD in entomology, which is the science of insects. And he doesn't come from UC Davis, but that's where he got his PhD. And after which he spent 3 years at University Pertanian Malaysia. Oh, sorry.
It's Putra now.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah,
they changed the name.
I like it, Pertanian. Yeah,
I like Pertanian. Like, yeah. Somebody's got to.
Putra's a feudal.
Somebody's got to, feed us. So the Pertanis. Okay. Anyway, so you were at UPM. Thanks for joining us. Yeah, of course. And this is no secret. It works at BFM. So we have a genuine PhD holder here. I had to say that, yeah. Okay. We are talking about something called the honor signal. And, you know, I guess for night school in general, we've not really gone to the natural sciences.
No, I can't think of another episode when we did, actually.
This is never.
The first one. You're a pioneer.
All that's right. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be the first.
Yeah, because I think it's about ideas. And, you know, the sciences are about ideas. Oh. The idea, of course, is that how do we even think about concepts in the natural sciences. And so we're going to start with this idea of the honor signal. And perhaps you could tell us just very briefly, where does it come from? What's the precursor to the whole discussion about this honor principle?
All right. So honor signalings.
Honor signal, right?
Yeah, honor signals. Yeah. Let's think about our gardens then. You know, if you wake up, when you wake up in the morning, and what do you hear? I hope you all hear birds singing in the morning.
The trucks running about. Yeah.
And
buses
trucks.
Yeah, okay. Into the neighborhood.
Well, let's ignore the trucks and the motorcycles for the moment. But if you hear the birds singing, they don't sing simple songs. It's often very complex, and it goes on for a long time, right? So why do they sing such complex songs? Why don't they just go beep, beep, beep for 3 seconds and then that's it? You know, I mean, why do you even ask the questions? Because when birds sing such complex songs for such a long time, it puts them in danger. Well, every cat in the neighborhood would know that the bird is singing. And if you can reach the bird's in, you know, grave danger. And in the same sense, we can extend this to peacocks, you know. That's the best example of this. Why do peacocks have such elaborate tails? I mean, it's beautiful, but it's also very heavy. It's long. It stops them from, you know, running away when the predator chases them. So why do peacocks have such long tails? And these were the questions, the sort of questions that puzzled Charles Darwin, you know, when he was formulating all his ideas on natural selection and evolution in his book On the Origin of Species, right?
So is Darwin the man who came on the stage to ask those questions about animals? Or had we as a civilization grapple with the question of what animals do without reference to us? See, because you could, you know, I guess you could take a religious point of view and think of, if you think of the biblical story, right, Genesis, the animals are there essentially to serve us. So they good meat, the meat is for us. You know, they're pretty, maybe it's about pleasuring us as human beings. If when you take human beings out of the equation, or you put them, put animals within the larger context of the environment, you know, and the questions change. I mean, when did that shift happen, really, for thinkers?
You mean it shifts from
a kind of human-centered approach to the question of animal behavior and purpose and function?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I can't tell you how long it's been before Darwin, but even since from Aristotle, right, it's always been there's this natural order, and humans are like at the very top, and everything just goes in. You know, when they used to talk about evolution, it's like evolving towards a better shape and form, and they don't look at each animal or plant, you know, its own way. But I don't know if Darwin was the first to think in this way, to shift away from a very human-centric perspective to really looking at the animals and why they exist. You know, for Darwin, when he was traveling on the Beagle, and he collected specimens of so many animals and plants, and he observed that they were so diverse. You know, the shapes, the functions, the colors, they were so diverse. And yeah, so and what puzzled him was like, why was there so much diversity? And he came up with a theory. You know, we call it theory now, although almost all biologists accept it as the law. You know, it's the law for natural selection, and it really moves away from a human-centric view. You know, the animals and plants are what they are. You know, they don't serve anybody. You know, in fact, they don't even serve nature. You know, often we hear people saying that, oh, you know, the bees serve the plants. You know, they have their function, their role in nature.
Like pollination.
Yeah, like pollination. It sounds so romantic, but we don't view it that way. You know, we don't view it that way. In fact, we view it as the bees do that because it benefits them. It benefits the bees, and the plants adopted their strategy because it benefited the plants. And when the bees and the plants, they, you know, however millions of years ago, when they came together, their ancestors, when they came together, their game plan matched and they evolved, you know, they adapted to each other.
So two things. I mean, sorry, you want to say something?
Yeah, so Darwin's original question is, why are there so many variations among species?
Yeah.
And this already puts his trajectory in a different light than, say, the religious account, which assumes that every species are zapped uniquely by God into existence. But what Darwin was to find later was that the variation had a lot to do with the choices that they would make, the various animal communities would make in order to survive or in order to propagate in numbers. But the human question were to be written later, because when he realized that ultimately the implications of natural selection has to, in the origin of species, has to account somehow for human existence, that was when he wrote The Descent of Man. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the two things I'm hearing, one is, in some strange parallel, is the question of, you know, enlightened self-interest. That, you know, one can, you're propelled by the logic of your own interest, but it could actually become coherent with the interests of others, right? So that's one thing. There's a kind of symbiosis or something that it forms.
Yep.
But it also raises the possibility of conflict, mm-hmm. right? The idea that different species might actually come in conflict with each other because their own trajectories or logics don't actually cohere, and there might actually be competition. So, which explains perhaps that species die out, that nature is not all about harmony, you know, and such, right?
Yeah, I just wonder too sometimes that on the point that where you said that, you know, animals don't think about serving nature or fitting into nature, they just go about their lives and do what they need to do. And I think this points to a very important implication that we often forget, that in order to understand natural selection, we cannot think of every individual animal as thinking in terms of survival. They're just going about their, okay, I want a mate, so I'm going to sing.
You kind of hit the nail on the head. Is it all about reproduction in the animal world?
Yeah.
Is it about
I was going to touch on was the consciousness, you know, for lack of a better word, all these animals, right? Mm-hmm. Natural selection operates at a larger level than individual or communities within a species.
Well, actually, natural selection acts on the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution acts on the bigger population.
Evolution,
but natural selection selects for each individual. Mm-hmm. And what does it select? It selects for the individuals, or perhaps I should say, the individuals with the traits that gives them the best chances of surviving and ultimately reproducing. No, if you can survive but you don't reproduce, it's an end game. Your genes don't get passed on. So yeah, just to answer Shira, yes, it is all about reproducing.
That's interesting.
Or passing on your genes.
Okay, passing on your genes. So that's an important distinction you just made, right? So the individual, and then there's the larger species, right?
The population.
Or the population that of that species,
mm-hmm.
is it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what is the connect in the animal world between the individual? I mean, come back to your question about consciousness. I mean, do animals actually have a sense of, you know, the community at large, you know?
Yeah, can we think that when a bird is singing, they're thinking, I need to pass my genes? I mean, they're not. I mean, or is it pleasure? I mean, it's a, It's a thing that humans have to ask too, right? Like we think
when,
of
when we made. Oh, okay, that's very technical. When we you know, when we
have sex.
Okay, yeah. When you're feeling romantic, do you think I need to have a child? I need to pass my genes.
Yeah.
Do we don't. Oh, I don't think we consciously think that.
Yeah.
Right?
No, exactly. We don't. Yeah.
Neither do the. We can never tell what the animals think, right?
But how do you does one determine that natural selection is at work when that bird is singing or the peacock is showing the tail, for example?
Evolution happens over a long time. And natural selection can happen right this instant. You know, if I walk out and I'm, you know, a very callous fellow, I don't look when I cross the road and I just get run over, natural selection has happened. I'm removed. Oh. My genes, my set of genes have been removed from the gene pool. Mm. Of course, some of it is retained in my siblings and my relatives, you know, and my parents and etc. And children, if I have any. But for evolution to happen, we have to look at a larger group. The population or the individuals that are reproducing among themselves. And we look at the genes that are available there. Okay, say if there are like 10 different genes, okay. Say there are 10 genes and then there are several versions of these genes. We call them alleles. And so evolution would have happened if over time the composition of these genes changed. And that would be evolution. So how do we know that peacock having the long tail is natural selection? Or why was Charles Darwin so puzzled? Well, because what natural selection says is that the peacock has survived all these years. This individual with his sets of genes has survived all these millions of years. It has passed all these millions of years of test. And so what it's expressing now should be adaptive. Yeah, that's our premise.
Okay,
that
so
it should be adaptive
rather than maladaptive.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
What's interesting about us as a species is that we constantly talk about ourselves and our apparently maladaptive practices and behaviors. Now, let's put humans aside because we're kind of cultural animals and we have that whole other issue to deal with. Mm-hmm. But for those species in the natural world, as it were, is it possible to think of a species developing maladaptive behavior?
Yeah, of course. What I mentioned just now is an assumption. It's the framework that we start, you know, that we base our work on. The starting assumption is that it is an adaptive trait. But if you find that you cannot explain what's the adaptation for this trait, you know, in Charles Darwin's case, that was how it was. You know, he saw birds with like long tails, you know, elaborate tails. Like this makes no sense in terms of natural selection. You know, you're flying, get caught on a branch. You know, it's so easy to spot you. So it doesn't improve your survival. So why have the bird retained these genes, you know, after all these years?
On that question, we're going to take a short break and come back. You were listening to Lau Yahua. He is an entomologist and more generally an animal person.
We're all animal persons.
Yeah, we're all animals.
No, but you personally, I mean your intellectual interests about animals. And of course, you've been listening to Fuad Rahmat. I'm Sharad Kutin, Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and Lau Yahua. If you didn't hear part one, we introduce him as an entomologist, or generally somebody interested in the environment and animals, and he's actually working at BFM. And has brought a whole new dimension, creepy crawlies, into the office. But seriously, folks, what we're talking about today is we're trying to get to this concept called the honor signal, but we've taken a long time getting there, and I don't know if we can start with that yet. But, Pat, what are the building blocks in terms of trying to understand the principles of animal behavior? We ended up with talking about adaptive and maladaptive behavior, both on an individual basis for animals, which would be natural selection, and on a species level, we talk about evolution, right?
Yeah. So you ask about, you know, could there be some traits that are actually maladaptive? Yeah, of course they are. Evolution is a dynamic process, right? So it should be. Our assumption is that, you know, the traits are adaptive, but that is when it's in equilibrium, or it has reached a stable state. If, you know, suddenly the environment changed, for example, now there's a huge flood comes and only the people with webbed feet can survive. Well, then before this, people with webbed feet probably is maladaptive. There's no need for that. But then now the challenges have changed. Suddenly the webbed feet have become an adaptive trait. So it depends on where you're looking, you know, at the point of time that you're looking at the trait. The more important thing is, just because you cannot find an adaptive value for that trait that we're looking at, what do you fall on? You can say that, you know, I used up all my research grant. I have no idea. You know, I will call it a maladaptive trait. It seems counterintuitive.
Can you just explain to us the process in which a biologist or a scientist or ethologist would determine that a trait is an adaptive trait? Because there's a range of traits in an animal that can suggest that it was adaptive at a given time, especially, like you said, the scientists will have to know that the context in which that trait grew over a long period of time as well. So what's the process? I mean, can you sketch it for our listeners?
Yeah, the comparison would be, it's actually not so simple. You know, talking about it is simple. The theory is actually simple and logical, but to test it is actually quite tough. You will need to show that the trait is adaptive. You will need to show that without the trait, the parameter that we are comparing would be what we call fitness. The number of offspring or the chance or how well the individual is able to survive and reproduce, the number of offspring that the individual can produce. So to know if one trait is adaptive or not, you would have to compare between individuals with different levels of that trait. The cleanest one would be with or without, and then compare their fitness, and that would be how you do it. So experimentally, you can imagine how difficult this would be to do. With insects, it might be easier. You know, you can sort of like manipulate, or you can change the environment to change the challenges, and you can test that. But with larger animals, it's very hard to experiment on tigers and elephants, so it can be very difficult.
Well, what is the point of this? I mean, I guess within the discipline, it might seem all it's set up to do that, right? But is there a point for all of us, I mean, who are not part of the discipline, not necessarily involved in the search for knowledge or of that sort? What can we draw from it? What do we learn about ourselves when we look at animals?
One implication I take it for that, we just happened. We weren't brought here for a purpose. We just happened along with nature. And, you know, it's hard for people to accept that.
I think the biggest contribution of the theory of natural selection and evolution is that it gives biology and natural sciences a framework to start our research. When we look at a behavior, when we look at how DNA works, you know, or when we look at how population grow or how diseases spread and the kind of stuff, different animals, different plants, like where do we come together? And it is this is a unifying theory for biology. We start with the assumption that all these individuals are selected, you know, the traits are selected, and they have survived till now because they have passed all this millions of years of tests. So we start with the assumption that there should be a function for each of these traits. There is a reason for this trait, and we expect that the traits will increase their fitness.
I pick up on the thing that you just said, which is that natural selection and evolution are a unifying theory.
In biology, which
is very interesting, because then it would have to account for the human species, right?
Yeah.
And where do you go with that?
How did we survive? You know, how did our traits now survive all those millions of years? We are so vulnerable to nature. We don't have fur. We don't have fangs. We don't have shells.
So yeah, right, for what, that, you know, humans as an animal, we are definitely very vulnerable to the elements of nature. But what makes us different, why we are so successful as a species, is that we have evolved brains.
But the strange thing is that the way we are consuming every day is effectively destroying our habitats, our brains. I mean, what I'm just trying to get exactly what aspect of our brain evolved that we can somehow manipulate nature, but we cannot see the consequences.
So maybe the distinction needs to be made between brain and brain functions, mm-hmm. and thinking, mm-hmm. and our ability to kind of assess the world as it changes, and we need to adapt. Because I think in anthropology, I'm just reaching back into Beyond the Cobwebs here, mm-hmm. but for all human communities, adaptive behaviors take several generations to prove themselves to be worthy, And so human beings actually have to learn over several generations, testing the kind of strategies they've used, right? So that's thinking, Brain is something that perhaps is the foundation for thinking, of a certain complexity of thinking, but isn't sufficient, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm certainly no expert on human evolution. That's a real, a very dynamic field on its own. But it's not just, I think I should follow up on Sharad's point. And Fuad's point, it seems that what we are doing now is we're destroying our habitats, and we seem to focus or to pursue rewards only in the short term. And I think that's true. And even for animals, I don't think any animals behave for the thinking that this will be good for my species in the long term. And that's not how biologists perceive animals too. No, they think as individuals, or at most I used the word think. Even I make that mistake. Now they behave in a way that benefits their own fitness, so their own immediate reproduction. And if it's good for the longer term, then it will be a trait that is retained in the gene pool. And so that would be an adaptive trait in the long term. After many generations of evolution, you see it there.
So as essentially, we're selfish.
Yeah, of course, we are selfish.
But all animals are. Yeah. I think that's the implication. All animals, to a certain degree, they are. Yeah. Can we go back to the question you started the discussion? What did Darwin say? Okay, Darwin said that these are strange behaviors that do not really serve their survival because they put them on the mm-hmm, threat. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how did he? What was his thought process?
So finally, that puzzled him to no end, and finally he came up with an alternative sort of to natural selection, and he called it sexual selection, where the trait in for example the long tail or the beautiful tail of the peacocks, instead of improving the peacock's survival, it improves the peacock's reproduction. It makes him more attractive to the females, and although he can't run away from a predator, but he gets the females. And he is able to outcompete the other females. Outcompete the other males, and then reproduce more. And so, with more offspring, then there'll be more copies of those of that gene in the gene pool.
So this stuff, this impulse to reproduce, is hardwired into all living beings. Is that true?
We think so. Yeah, we think so.
That's an assumption that biologists make.
Yes, yeah, because if the end game is not to, reproduce, then your genes cannot pass on. And if your genes are not passed on, then you won't be here. So if you are here, that means you might die one day, but if you are here, what it meant is you were a drop in a long continuous river. And all your ancestors before you, they all reproduced successfully. That's why you are here. And yeah, so reproduction is it's really the game. But reproduction doesn't necessarily mean that you mate and you have an offspring. It's the genes that get passed on. So if I don't reproduce, but I help my brother or my sisters reproduce and have a zillion offsprings, I'm successful too.
That is very interesting, because it also is the foundations for some theories about the gay individual. and about yes, altruism. Yes, right? Yes, yes. So but we don't have to go into that question because it is a rather complex one. But so you have the idea of the selfish gene, but you also have altruistic behavior that can be explained because what is important is the gene and the gene yep. pool, not necessarily the individual survival, right?
Yep.
I'm just imagining this peacock here glorifying its tail and mm-hmm. getting, you know, the mating process, even though it is aware of the risk. I think at some point word had gotten around in its community that there is a risk. Now,
the daily peacock. They broke a story on the daily peacock.
You know, word on the street. Are we saying there is the subtext here I'm getting is that reproduction is worth risking death for in most cases?
Yeah.
And something very human about that too.
It's a trade-off. So when we look at, you know, an animal's behavior, so we have to remember that the context is that the behaviors have been selected for, right? And so we start with the assumption that there is a function. And there's a reason why this animal is behaving this way, and so why and you know when it chooses to reproduce instead of feed, you know, instead of like looking for food, why? Okay, perhaps it's not hungry, so it will gain the most by forsaking foraging and going for a mate. Why? On the other end, if it's behaves very risk in a very risky manner, you know, it sees a tiger, but still it went out and grabbed the female. Why? Perhaps, you know, it's near its end of its life, and it has never mated, and so it gains the most by mating, okay? Instead of like worrying about the tiger. I mean, if it hides all the time, it's not gonna get a mate. It might survive, but in the end, its genes doesn't get passed on, so that won't be an adaptive behavior. So, and there are many examples that show that animals actually do choose. You know, they can make choices. You know, they're not hardwired to do, to behave in the same way all the time. So they would assess the challenges, you know, the environment, you know, what are the options available, and then they make a choice. They might not be thinking like we humans think, but in the genes, you know, there is a plan for them to make the choice according to the situations.
Now, just to clarify the term thinking here, because I imagine, I mean, the idea that a sentient being makes a choice, mm-hmm. I would say credit that with thinking. But maybe there are different types of thinking, and the kind of thinking that perhaps animals don't do, most animals don't do, is the kind that involves self-reflexivity and self-consciousness. So we see, studies of animals I remember in the study of chimpanzees, for instance, or primates, the idea that you show a mirror to an animal, right? So the animal recognizes itself. So chimpanzees, higher order primates, can recognize themselves. And, you know, there was this test where they put a little dot on the forehead of the chimpanzee, and the chimpanzee, looking in the mirror, touches their own forehead rather than reach out and touch the dot in the mirror, right? So there's a sense of self, mm-hmm. and that reflexivity that comes from self. But and that's probably a high order thinking, but, you know, my cats, I assume, mm-hmm. Think they make choices, like they love me more than they love than my neighbors.
Is that adaptive? You feed them, of course it's adaptive.
Of course it's adaptive. Of course. I clean their litter.
Survivors.
I brush them. Survivors. They love me. Of course it's adaptive.
Now, human beings, they're so wired to thinking about mating in terms of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how characteristic is that of most vertebrate mammals or not? Is that just our thing and the ones closest to our species, or is it a broader story across the animal kingdom?
I can't say, because I focus most of my time studying insects, and if it's pleasurable, you think that they'll do it again and again, even if it's not for reproducing.
Correct.
Right? And very few animals have been documented to do that. You know, dolphins are one, humans definitely.
The bonobos, monkeys?
Yeah, some of the non-human primates do that. But not for insects. So every time, or not for most other animals, every time they do it, there's ejaculation. So it does serve
And that's just the end. That's the end of the story. Game over. I'm gonna have a cigarette. See you next time, baby.
The male says, "I'll move on to the next female," and the female is left thinking, "Did I make the best choice?"
Ah,
yeah.
There you go. The thinking thing again.
See. I use that word too.
No, yeah. but the fact that it's not decoupled from mating doesn't mean it's not there. So it could be pleasure plus that. Yeah. They can't separate the concept. Pleasure,
there are definitely sensations involved.
Yeah.
But for many, I would say for many insects, if you just look at the morphology that's involved, it won't be that pleasurable, because many of the male insects have penises that have hooks, you know. The same thing with ducks, you know. You can't say that, it's hard to imagine that mating is pleasurable in ducks, you know. You have like 4 or 5 males, you know, ganging up on one female, and the penises are, you know, spiny and long, and yeah, it doesn't look pleasurable at all. But perhaps it is.
Oh, I more see. Research is that what ducks do that?
Yeah, you should, you know, Google it and look at, like, Google duck penises and...
Or duck mating.
Duck mating. Okay, I maybe on a slow news day, that would be... But, okay, again, we tried desperately to come back to...
How did you spend your college days? You know, what did you do?
They didn't have YouTube then.
Ah, yes.
We only ate duck. We didn't actually watch... I was in Singapore, for God's sakes. I mean, the only ducks you encounter were the supermarkets, you know, so... so have we answered the question of the honest signal? We haven't come to that, have we?
I wonder if we have enough time.
Okay, very quickly, in terms of, you laid out the unified theory of animal behavior, that's, you know, the...
Natural selection, evolution.
That's right. Where does honest signaling appear in that system of knowledge that we have about animals?
Actually, does it parallel and complement natural selection, or is it a different kind of rival theory to natural selection? What was the relationship?
Sexual selection doesn't negate natural selection. It just offers an alternative view to explain all these elaborate, like, sexual ornaments that we see in nature. But in the end, it's still the same thing. Like, it improves the individual's chances of, you know, reproducing and propagating its genes. So the end game is the same between natural selection and sexual selection, except that they might be expressed in different ways. So back to honest signals, right? So... sexual selection, okay, so the females prefer these elaborate decorations, the peacock tails, blah, blah, blah. Why? Why do the females prefer this? You know, why don't they prefer something plainer? Why don't they prefer a peacock with a short tail? But the logical reason would be that males with elaborate decorations are indicating their better qualities. So if it's a proxy to tell the female, hey, I'm better, because I have a longer tail, or I can sing more complex songs, I'm better. And so they are signaling, the males are signaling to the female, indicating to them their quality and why the females should choose them. But why should the females believe the males? No. What makes these signals honest? So that's where this honest signaling comes in. And Zahavi, so Ahmad Zahavi is the Israeli professor who came up with this idea in 1975, and he called it the handicap hypothesis or the handicap principle. Basically, it goes like this. A signal will be honest if it's costly, if it's an expensive signal. Okay, if I'm to convince you that I'm rich, what would I do?
Show money.
Jewelry, yeah, show money.
Stuff.
Buy expensive things.
Buy expensive thing. You know, I dress expensively, you know, lavishly. I will, you know, buy you lots of expensive stuff. And I'm signaling to you that I'm rich. Why? Because a guy who is poorer cannot maintain such a lifestyle. He cannot sustain that. So it is very costly to me, and it seems to be illogical. You know, why is he spending all this money? But I'm signaling to you, you know, if you are my target, that, hey, I can do this because I can afford to. And the poor guy, the poorer guy, he cannot do this because he cannot afford to. So the more costly the signal, the more honest it should be.
So for the peacock and the peacock example, what is the cost involved in having this elaborate feathering thing?
That's actually a key point. The honest signal, it was a verbal argument. It was a verbal model, okay, proposed by Zahavi, And then later it was modeled mathematically, and it was at first criticized, and it was only about 20 years later, in 1990, that a mathematical model actually proved that it works. And then it gained popularity. Now every student in animal behavior knows this, but there are very, very few empirical evidence for it. For the peacock, there is evidence that it is an indicator of good genes, because peacocks with longer tails also produce healthier offspring. But they cannot show that it is costly. It's the cost that's very tricky. How do you show that having a long tail is costly, whereas having a short tail is not as costly? You must be able to show that individuals with longer tails suffer in some way.
Or open themselves to risk of some sort.
Yeah. So that cost is actually very hard to pin down. And in the review, in a review of all the biological literature, only a handful of studies have been able to show that there is a costly signal that indicates good genes, and that it is indeed costly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So there we have. Finally, we got an answer before.
Well, it's actually a very we are not doing justice to the honor signal at all.
No, but still, it's good enough.
I learned a lot anyway. Yeah,
I did. But before we go, we need to ask you for a recommendation for a book, if you have one.
Yeah. So a good book to read would be the book titled Animal Signals by John Maynard Smith and David Harper. So it was published in 2004.
Right.
So that would be a good book to read.
Great.
Okay. I would suggest Jared Diamond's The Third Chimpanzee as a way of understanding human beings in relation to all these other animals and the kind of behaviors that we think are unique. He's also got a much more complicated book with the title Why Is Sex Fun? But it's actually it's a slim book, but it's actually extraordinarily difficult to think because it has many of these discussions that we've had here about genes.
I'd suggest Animal Wise by Virginia Morell. She's an ethologist, and again, like Sharad as well, it's about humans and the relationship to other animals, in particular in light of how animals behave. And there are a lot of interesting insights there.
Right, great. So we all acknowledge that we're animals and part of the animal world. That's very sweet. It's time that we roar out of here. Thanks again, Yahua. We're going to have
you
back because we really need to up our quotient on natural sciences.
We do.
And this was great fun. And you were listening also, of course, to Ahmad Fuad Ramat, who's not on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Sharad Kutan. Are you on Twitter?
I am. So it's just my name, Yahua Lau.
And so you can tweet him, me, and carry on this conversation on Facebook. That's all we have for you this week. Join us next week on Night School. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.